Hey guys, what's up? It is week 329. And I have a handful of reviews, an update, a Patreon drawing for the patrons to see what other movies I'll be watching. But let's hop right into the reviews. And the first one up is going to be controversial, I guess. I would say so. And this is from 2009. And this is the 4K release from Arrow Video. And this is the remake of The Last House on the Left. Now, everybody knows the original, if you're probably tuning into this channel. I've talked about that probably extensively. I'm sure I've covered it a couple times on here. I have a great affinity for the original film. Wes Craven, 1972, his first directed film starring David Hess. It's a lightning in a bottle kind of time and place movie. It helped kind of kickstart the nihilism in a lot of 70s cinema in America. Along with like Bonnie and Clyde, Night of the Living Dead, Wild Bunch, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I mean, Last House on the Left is one of the most important, you know, horror films or films of the 70s, if you're looking at it from that aspect. It was often ripped off, even though it's kind of a semi-remake of The Virgin Spring by Bergman in itself. So the Last House on the Left is a movie that the history of it and the impact of it is even more interesting than the movie itself. So saying that, in the early 2000s, there was a huge remake craze that went up all the way into, you know, probably the mid-2010s or so, with lots of things being remade, including, you know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, and then we started hitting some of the kind of bigger, more kind of, I wouldn't say obscure, but more brutal films being remade in Last House on the Left and I Spit on Your Grave. It seemed like they were a bit remake crazy. Now, earlier in 2005, there was a movie called Chaos that started off as an official Last House on the Left remake by David DeFalco, I believe he was directing that, and it starred Kevin Gage and Sage Stallone. And what happened was that it kind of fell through. David Hess was supposed to be in it from the original, Krug, and it just didn't work out. So that movie came out, and although it is not the most beloved movie by fans, I think that when you're making something like The Last House on the Left that's gritty and dark, and you want to recreate that kind of feeling, that gut punch, I think that it works for what it is. Now, saying that about the 2009 Last House on the Left, so this is a bigger budgeted film, Universal, a lot of money, very polished, and it opens up right in the beginning. You can just tell that this is on a different level. And I'm almost 100% positive. I really should have double-checked there. In the very opening of this film, I believe one of those police officers is Michael Bowen, who's an excellent actor in a slew of things like Jackie Brown, The Lost, and Forbidden. One of the Corman films is when he got his original start. So saying this, now before I kind of get into the negatives and positives of Last House on the Left remake, I don't want to go through the whole ordeal versus and everything like that. I do not have a strong love for a lot of movies made during probably 2000 to 2000, you know, 11, 12. It's just there's something a lot about them. And a lot of the serious darker tone stuff, including the Mother's Day remake, the I Spit in Your Grave remake, and the Last House on the Left remake, always kind of just rubbed me the wrong way when I revisited them. I thought that they have a certain, some of them want their cake and want to eat it too. And other times they are very dead serious and act as if they are saying something about humanity, but they're just not realistically written. And they come across very contrived at times. And my problem with this film is in general is it doesn't have conviction. It wants to walk the line when you can't. So when we're talking about remakes in general, right? You either, I would say, want to do one of two things, right? You can have a little kind of touches and goes, right? Dawn of the Dead, for example, the remake of Dawn of the Dead in 2004, I think is a successful remake, but it doesn't take the approach of trying to kind of update the original story. It basically does its own thing. The only thing that's similarity is there's zombies in a mall. Besides that, there's nothing really similar except zombies get shot in the head. They change a lot of things around. I don't think it's a proper updated version of the original. I don't think it's trying to be. I think it's trying to do its own thing. If you look at Romero's original Crazies and you see the remake, they didn't go for a lot of that kind of Romero-style social commentary and the miscommunication. They went more for an action horror paranoia film, which was fine as well. And then if you look at something like the 1990 Night of the Living Dead, that's kind of like an updated version of the original story. Now, they take some of the impact away, they do, but it's kind of fitting into the mold of the original in certain ways, the irony at the end and all that kind of stuff. So I would feel that that is more the approach of trying to update the original version. The Blob is kind of a great updated version of its from 88, from the 58 version, though it changes some of the details, but that's fine. You can't keep it all straight. Now, the Last House on the Left remake, to me, wants the harshness, the brutality, wants the shock factor, but it doesn't want to go 100% to commit to it. But it wants to show you brutality and a rape, but it won't commit to the blow your brains out, the piss your pants scene, the ending that leaves you numb. So the original Last House on the Left, if anybody's read about Craven's things about it, he mentions, you know, wanting, seeing a Western, probably a Sergio Leone Western in the theaters, and everybody's dropping dead, you know, and just it's unceremonious deaths left and right. And he felt disgusted by that. He wanted to show violence for what it was, as Peckinpah said as well. He wanted to show violence had an impact and also show that revenge seems cathartic at points, but then at the end, what's left? The remake doesn't do that. The remake leaves this semi-happy ending that leaves you often baffled and confused as to what the point of this movie was at all, if there was no point except kind of a weaker cash-in of the original. But there's no problem with them showing a brutal rape scene. Now, let me get into say some things positive about this movie. I don't want to 100% attack this. It is well-directed, right? As there's a script to the page. I don't love the script is my concern with it, but it's well-directed. It's a very expensive, gorgeous-looking movie and kind of the darkness of it. And it's high-budget brutality. I know that a lot of the kind of movies being made during this time had some like really well-made brutality. Hollywood was kind of getting in on it, you know. Films like Eden Lake were well-made brutality. Even I Spit on Your Grave remake, not as well-made as this, of course, budget-wise and just as effective, I would say not, probably, honestly not. But there was good, fine acting in that by some people. This one, you know, it's a really well-made film. The opening is really strong. The actors are good. Sarah Paxton is excellent in this. She's a good actress. The parents, Tony Goldwyn and the wife, they're good. The gang, Aaron Paul, like anybody say these actors are not good is not really wrong. I don't know if they're 100% cast correctly, but then again, I don't know if you can really create something like a dark exploitation, nihilistic movie in Hollywood past like 1984. I just don't know if it really rings true. Taking something so powerful and regional and lightning in a bottle that probably shouldn't have worked on paper and then trying to update that into a version that's polished and clean, I just don't see the reasoning for it. I don't think it has the impact that it wants to act like it has. It has, like I said, it wants its cake to eat it too. It doesn't have conviction. But I know a lot of people like this version better than the original. The original is an ugly movie. It's a low-budget movie. There's technical problems. There's tonal shifts that don't match. But it's short, and it's brutal, and it gets its point across, and it makes you feel sick. This one, it's long. It's almost 2 hours long, which is bizarre. I think that's a bit long for this. And in reality, with all that, they don't really establish the characters as much as you would like. Even if you really need to. I mean, I think that another thing about Last House on the Left that's as good is it's just as basic. Basic parents, basic kids, basic villains. I mean, not all basic villains. David Hess, there's nothing basic about him. But they just, you know who they are. And you can put yourself in the parents or the kids' situation at any different walks in your life, you know? The soundtrack is also something in here that's well done. It does not do the folk kind of music that Hess wrote, which is probably, hard to recreate. It has to do its own thing in certain aspects. But again, it wants to have both. And I don't know how I feel about that. I think it's well shot. I think the practical effects are really good. I think the fight choreographing stuff is really strong. I like the setting of that it's raining. And it just is kind of like a backdrop that it's a big storm. Now, and how it's shot and everything, it plays a factor into that. Now, something like the I Spit on Your Grave remake just was drained of color. And I thought that looked like crap. Well, this one, it's definitely made by a good cinematographer, a good director, these aspects here. Now, saying that, I think it is worth checking out. If you like the movie, the 4K looks great. The theatrical version's in 4K, then the director's cut, or the unrated cut, I should say, is in Blu-ray. But if you are a fan of the film, the 4K release is really crisp looking, looks really solid, good sound design, all that kind of stuff. And then again, you have the unrated version, which mostly there's character development stuff in there, but the rape scene is longer, there's more alternate takes, that kind of deal. As far as the special features, which is what really kind of intrigued me on this movie the most, is because it's like a subgenre that I am unfortunately fascinated by just because the history of it and how they handle it and, you know, just how, you know, what it is, right? You know, just how things are handled in such a touchy subject and the time, how it changes throughout time. That's why something like Promising Young Woman was super refreshing and different. And I was like, oh, I don't think I've ever seen it quite handled that way. Or Ladies Club or Gun for Jennifer. There's a lot of different kind of alternate takes on her Rape of Richard Beck that are just interesting, right? Or different and very taboo subject matter, obviously. But as far as the special features are concerned on the theatrical 4K version, we have exclusive new filmed introduction by director Dennis Illadis, brand new audio commentary by David Flint and Adrian Smith, A River of Blood, a new 30-minute interview with Sarah Paxton. I like this. I like this a lot. She's a very intelligent actress. She talks about learning how to swim, all sorts of stuff. Like, they put a lot of hard work into this, and she's good in it. She gives a very brave, tough performance. The Notorious Krug, a new 27 interview with Garrett Dillahunt. Now, for me, he's a good actor, and I know he's undone a bunch of other films and everything. The way Krug is portrayed in this movie is they're trying to go for more of a two-dimensional, maybe even three-dimensional character, and it just doesn't work for me. I just don't know what they're trying to do with the character. The actor's good. It's just Hess is one of those people that's completely irreplaceable, and he, in Last House on the Left, is probably one of the two, three things that make that movie really work, honestly. And without him, his absence is sorely missed. He cannot be replaced. And they just don't tend to have character actors anymore or actors that look like Hess around or somebody like a Warren Oates or any of these kind of guys. So it's hard. It's very hard to do. And this is a Hollywood kind of production. So, you know, it's just not something that I sorely missed as Hess. Still a good actor, still interesting. And he talks about, you know, character actors and stuff like that in there and the people he likes. Scarecrow, he mentions the film Scarecrow. So it's like he is a cinephile. So it's just a shame. And I don't want to pin this all on the scriptwriter either or anything like that. I just don't think it was the right place or the right time. And it's just completely not made for somebody like me. We have Suspending Disbelief, a new 18-minute interview with the screenwriter Carl Ellsworth. Now, here's where I think he kind of focused. He wanted to make a thriller film. Less horror, less kind of step away from that brutality that Wes Craven did. Unfortunately, he had never heard of the original Last House on the Left when he sat down to write this. So he didn't understand the impact, probably, I don't think. Maybe he... I think that this is a movie that stays with somebody a long time. They think about it and they kind of look at horror. He's not a horror fan, so he can't take a step. Maybe he could take a step back as a non-horror fan and look at how it changed the horror landscape. But in a way, when you watch a lot of horror movies, you can just see how impactful this movie was and what it was. And reading the history books and listening to scholars and historians, you know that this movie really had such a powerful hit at its time. And this writer, I don't think, knows what the original was. So when he does an updated version, the mark is missed for what it's supposed to do, I think, personally, and stuff like that. So and then we have Reviving the Legend, a new 33-minute interview with producer Jonathan Craven, Wes Craven's son. And this is also interesting, talking about the original, talking about The Hills Have Eyes, how he liked those. And I think his stuff is probably the most insightful about the film and about his father and everything like that. Then look inside featurette from the film's original 2009 release, deleted scenes, theatrical trailer, image gallery. And then, of course, we have the unrated version in Blu-ray. So if you like the film, it's a great 4K. If you're interested in the film, it's definitely worth exploring. If you're like me, maybe giving it a revisit. I posted a review and there's so many people that like this one better, or hated the original completely. And I mean, I understand if you don't like the original, or you like this one. I just would like some reasoning, right? I have my reasoning, and you can like whatever you want or dislike whatever you want. It's just the people that don't really have a genuine reason or an understanding of why they like or dislike something that I just don't very much take their opinion very seriously. But Last House on the Left 2009, I do like seeing these releases. I'd like to see Eden Lake. I'd like to revisit Eden Lake. I'd like to see some other movies Arrow put out, some from a different time. There's a lot of good ones. Like, hopefully they dive into some of those dimension extremes and we get stuff like Inside on 4K and Blu-ray and whatnot. That's a great film. So yeah, Last House on the Left remake, check it out if it sounds like it's up your alley. Okay, the next one here is quite ridiculous. I don't know how much I'm going to have to say about this one, but this is from Cauldron Films, and this is Frankenstein 80 from 1972, funny enough. And yeah, Cauldron Films has released some pretty wacky, crazy movies, and this is no different. I've never actually seen this rendition of Frankenstein. It's actually an Italian flick, of course, and the big name for me is Gordon Mitchell. Gordon Mitchell's in a slew of kind of gothic horror movies from Italy around this time, and especially before, a little bit after, everything like that. Wasn't he even in that bloody Blood Delirium years down the line? So it is kind of a classic Frankenstein tale, but it's kind of not. It fits in line with something like Lady Frankenstein, another Italian sleazy Frankenstein movie, or even Flesh for Frankenstein, but I would just say not as artful as Flesh for Frankenstein by Paul Morrissey. But here we go. So Gordon Mitchell is Dr. Frankenstein. And in the very beginning, we have almost like this, it feels like a giallo-style murder with gloves and everything. I was like, what is going on here? Is he stealing the parts or what's going on? But then you realize it's actually the monster going around killing people in this style. And so, of course, the monster runs amok at night, and he goes out and he frequents prostitutes. And there's this really hilarious scene. If you guys ever seen the scene in The Burning, right, when Cropsey tries to pick up the prostitute, and she's like, oh, I take your man. And it's like that scene, like times 10. She's like, come over here. And he like leaves money. And then like she sees the scars all over his face, but when he takes it off and she sees the scars in his body, I think that's like the crossing point. Like, it's like, what is this? What are we watching? This is essentially Frankenstein the Rapist, which is a title of a Beelzebub movie that would get made years down the line, which I never watched. But yeah, so Frankenstein's monster goes around, or technically Frankenstein the Rapist because of Frankenstein, because he, Peter Cushing, rapes some poor woman in that. But and that's the name of the guy and the doctor, not whatever, the Frankenstein monster's rapist or whatever. So basically he goes around the monster raping and ripping apart people until the climax where him and Gordon Mitchell are going to face off. It's funny seeing Gordon Mitchell go against the monster because like that guy's huge and giant, and it's just like, I think he actually in real life could whoop the guy playing the monster's ass, so that's always a little fun. It's cheesy, gory, sleazy, kind of schlocky, if you will, Frankenstein 1972, or Frankenstein 80 from 1972. I enjoyed it, I'm not going to lie. I like these kind of things, though. These are totally up my alley. As far as the special features are concerned, we have Dahlia Forever, the recorded memories of Dahlia de Lazzararo, Little Frankenstein, History of Italian Frankenstein Films with Domenico Minetti, and commentary by film historian Heather Drain. That's really funny. She has some good laughs, some good insight. It's a fun movie. I would recommend it. Frankenstein 80. Yeah, great stuff. Okay, the next one here is by Adrian Boglana Garcia, and he's done a slew of movies. He did Here Comes the Devil and Late Phases. Late Phases is a really good film. And this is Black Circle. Now, this is made in Sweden, and it's in Swedish, which is kind of crazy. And this is released by Synapse Films. Now, this movie I've been hearing about a long time, and I was always wanting to check it out, but it never really got a release stateside. Finally, we get it. So it says 2019, but I think that this is technically the first time it's been released stateside. So what we have here is a role for Christina Lindbergh. Last week I watched Thriller, Cruel Picture. You guys know Christina Lindbergh, Swedish icon, cult actress extraordinaire. She's much older in this, but good. So this is a bizarre film. I don't even know how to go about it. So this girl, kind of down on her luck, goes back to kind of live with her sister a little bit. Her sister's in a new town. She seems very successful, and her sister says, listen, you need to listen to this album that I found on the B-side. Just lay down at night and check it out and listen to it. I like these kind of horror movies where it's like an auditory sound or hypnotizing or something weird like that, mental, that can turn physical, kind of like scariness. I like that kind of stuff. So basically he says, listen to this, it'll change your life. And this girl sits down, she starts to listen to the album, and strange things, she starts to kind of have these surreal trips and everything. Before long, her sister comes back to her and tells her, I made a mistake, you need to get away from that album, and there's somebody been after me ever since. And she takes a look out the window, and it's her car sitting out there. He's like, how'd they get your car? And it goes into this long story. They're following me. They won't stop following me. They lead to go to the people who produced this album. And there's this old kind of institute where these people were obsessed with hypnotism. And the owner has since passed away under strange circumstances, as they all do. And Christina Lindbergh and company tell them that something crazy has happened and that you have a doppelganger and we need to get them back together. It's strange. And they set all these kind of elaborate sci-fi kind of rules that to find out who the double is. One can't follow the other one, and the sister's much further gone. And of course, there's a backstory involving Christina Lindbergh, who didn't want to do this anymore because something tragic happened, and they didn't want to continue the experiments, and now they have to face it. This is a good film. It's well acted. It's interesting enough. It's creepy. There's a couple genuine scares. And the concept is a good one. I like these movies that do a lot of conceptual stuff in there. It doesn't need to be the biggest budget film ever made, but as long as it has a great concept and solid acting and interesting filmmaking techniques, I think that it's pretty good, you know, and this one is all that. Adrian Bogalana Garcia is a good director. He's an underrated director. He's been directing movies for a lot longer than people think he has in Spain, but, you know, I think his biggest one is probably Late Phases. He has a couple others that I think a lot of horror aficionados would know, but this one is Black Circle. I think they're supposed to release one of his rape revenge movies early on in his career, Synapse, but I don't think it ever did come out. But I would check Black Circle out. Now, it's just fine that it's kind of such an interesting thing here, right? It's a Swedish movie made by a Spanish guy in Sweden, I think. But we have haunting original motion picture soundtrack included in compact disc, audio commentary with director Adrian Garcia Bogalano, original teaser trailer, Don't Open Your Eyes, original short film, interview with Bogalano and Christina Lindbergh, Inside Black Circle, Behind the Scenes Featurette, and Still Gallery. This is region free as well, so check out Black Circle. Okay, the next one up is from 1978-77, and this is, I think, Don Doler's directorial debut. This is a Baltimore regional filmmaker. He made a bunch of stuff, including Night Beast and Fiend, and this one, Alien Factor. So this is a pretty fun film, and I don't know if this is the first kind of storyline like this. So Don Doler made a bunch of movies, like I said, in Baltimore area. He used some of the same actors you'd always see. Biggest actor he probably used regularly was George Stover, who would be in a bunch of John Waters films and cult films as well. And so Don Doler tended to make the same movie over and over again in different variations of it. So in 1978, he made Alien Factor, which is basically about a spacecraft that crash lands, and all these kind of alien zoo creatures that were going to like an expedition get loose in this small town, and they start picking people off. The mayor is essentially pulling the jaws. There's an amusement entertainment like park that they're going to put up here. We don't want to stir the pot and make everything, you know, go crazy, all that kind of stuff like that. So he's kind of trying to keep it down low. Meanwhile, there is like three monsters ravaging the countryside, including a bug man and some sort of tall guy on stilts. And then of course we have the final creature, which is a cool reveal, and he's kind of semi-invisible. Reminds me of the Lovecraft creature, right? Was that Dunwich? Whichever one has the invisible creature that they can't really see. Anyways, this is a fun movie. It is low budget. It's very regional. There's very poor decisions made by a lot of the cast, including within the first 10 minutes, two people are drunk driving. But hey, it is what it is. And just kind of like, it does seem to meander a little bit, almost like they were going very loose script or not script at all. I like the monsters. The kill count is high, like all Doler's films. And all of them come from space. Even the Fiend, you're like, oh, this is some sort of occult dead thing. It's like, no, it came from space too. Everything. So like his horror films he did, you know, or horror sci-fi with Alien Factor, The Fiend, Night Beast, Blood Massacre, and Galaxy Invader. And then he went on to do Alien Factor 2 and some other ones. But during his heyday, all his movies were kind of like sci-fi horror films where the alien crash lands and starts killing a bunch of people, and it's up to the townspeople or the sheriff or somebody to stop them. I'm doing Alien Factor right now because I'm going to be next on the show, Sick on Cinema, next week to discuss Don Doler and three films. And one of them is, of course, Alien Factor. But as far as the special features are concerned, we have new cast and clue commentary track, behind the scenes featurette, blooper reel, alternative Lemanoid sequence and commentary track, the television years, meet the cast and crew featurette, Alien Factor reunion, original retro media drive-in edition, a drive-in theater episode. There we go. Alien Factor. All right, guys, let's hop into those 1981 movies.
Woe be unto him who opens one of the seven gateways to hell, because through that gateway, evil will invade the world.
We'll be right back. say on a Valentine's Day is a curse that'll live on. And no one will know as the years come and go of the horror from long time ago. In this little town, when the 14th comes round, there's a silence and fear in the air. Remember the morn that the legend was born, all the shock and the horror was there. Or the legend they say on a Valentine's Day is a curse that'll live on and on. And no one will know as the years come and go of the horror from long time ago. And no one will know as the years come and go of the horror from long time ago.
First Up is by Michael Crichton, and this is more of a sci-fi thriller, but I do see horror aspects in it. Even in the beginning, there's some giallo kind of little themes in there. And this is Looker. Now, I know a couple of people recommended this to me to check out, and I had it on my radar. I had it on my master list for 81 already. And this is Albert Finney and James Coburn in it. I feel like there's somebody else in here I should mention. Susan Day, she's really good in this. Leia Taylor-Young and Vanna. From Wheel of Fortune is in here as well. So Albert Finney is like a world-class plastic surgeon expert, and he works on a lot of models, a lot of people who are really high-stress jobs. So one day this woman comes in and says, "I want you to do a job." And he's like, "You're gorgeous. What are you talking about?" And she has this list of minor imperfections that just are, you know, not the goal to have a perfect face. And it's minus, like, it's like random, like just one, like half a millimeter or something, all this kind of random stuff. And at first he doesn't want to do it, but somebody convinces him, says, "Hey, somebody else is going to do it. It's going to be worse." So he ends up doing it for her. And pretty soon enough, all the people that he's recently worked on, they all start to be killed in really strange ways or die. At first it looks like suicide, but as he digs deeper, he registers that there may be a big mustachioed man on orders of someone carrying out these murders. And he gets 100% in there. His last remaining person that is on the possible victim list, he kind of joins together and they kind of try to do their whole deal and figure out this case. It leads them into a wild world of AI. And this is way ahead of its time here. The idea that they're going to basically take carbon pictures of actors or models and use them for, you know, commercials or whatever they want. That's in here. There's also these strange ideas and elements about a stun gun, basically a literal stun gun that when a light stun gun, when you get hit with it, you kind of have moments of lost time. And there's a lot of playful stuff with that, especially when more than one character gets it, which leads to hilarity. And the end is true. Like Jeremy was watching part of this. It reminds me of something from Adult Swim. It's so bizarre and so ahead of its time, but also so funny and clever. It really does feel like too many cooks in the kitchen. Remember that skit where it broke like the fourth wall? It reminds me of that in certain aspects where we have a shootout going directly AI to the audience, but they're seeing the people that are there. It's just a super bizarre idea too. And they even bring up the point that says, yeah, they're 100% perfect on paper with their looks, but when they start moving, that changes everything, right? So there's that, you know, an image or a image uploaded to a computer can never really replace anyone. But there's just these ideas and themes within the movie that are really genius. And Albert Finney's great, and James Coburn's solid. But yeah, it's a really strong film. It's unique and different, and I really liked Looker. Next up here is kind of another thriller, but it's by a big cult kind of director. And I thought it was a great follow-up to Dress to Kill. And I heard so many good things about this film, and it was a huge blind spot. So I ended up picking up the 4K of Blowout, which is probably one of Brian De Palma's most popular movies. And, you know, I've seen a lot of Brian De Palma's movies, and I've liked every single one of them. So I was like, well, you got to watch Blowout. I know it's, like I said, more of a thriller, but it does have some horror aspects. It probably won't be included in my top 25 just because it's so much not a horror film. And this one stars John Travolta, of course, but it also has Nancy Allen. And there's a bunch of other people in here, too. Dennis Franz pops back up. And that's funny because Dennis Franz and Nancy Allen are both in Dress to Kill. It also has John Lithgow in it and a slew of other familiar faces. But yeah, this one is great. So it's got like a bunch of, like I said, De Palma regulars. Travolta being in Carrie, and Dennis Franz being in Dressed to Kill, Nancy Allen being in Dressed to Kill as well. So, yeah, John Travolta is a sound guy, and the opening of this film was brilliant. It reminds me a lot of Phantom of Paradise, where it's, like, playing on the audience, right? The Phantom of Paradise by Brian De Palma has all those different musical cues and styles and changes everything, kind of parodying it. Well, this one parodies a slasher film, and I absolutely want to watch that slasher film, and the opening of this movie is so bad. It looks like a lot of fun. But then we kind of realize, like, we break the kind of, like, fourth wall, but we kind of register what's happening here. Kind of like Killer Party does the same thing in the very beginning. We kind of register that they're watching a film as, you know, this horrible scream kind of enters the frame from one of the actresses in the film, within the film, which is absolutely hilarious and everything like that. So Travolta is a sound guy, and he's out there recording Foley on a bridge, and he witnesses this car go off the bridge and sink into the water. He sees Nancy Allen in there, and he dives in the water and pulls her out. And when he gets to the hospital, you know, some government officials say, listen, it was the governor in that car. He was probably going to be the next president. He's dead. We'd like you to keep your mouth shut and say you didn't see him because he was, you know, he was with somebody that's not his wife. But John Travolta thinks something's fishy, and he wants to talk to Nancy Allen about it. Nancy Allen's great in this. If you think about Nancy Allen, she's so versatile. If you look at Dressed to Kill, she plays a call girl, and she's really, like, ambitious and highly intelligent and very, like, just super smart. And this one, she plays very kind of ditzy. I wouldn't say a call girl, but you know what I mean. She's a model, a nude model, or a model, and she does things on the side to get paid. And she's so ditzy and bizarre in this. Complete 180 of a character, even though they kind of share a similar profession. So they start to look into things, and one thing leads to another, and before long there's an assassin on their tail, and played brilliantly by John Lithgow. Very cold, very reserved, very scary. His calls on the payphones are awesome. When he's talking to the politician, it's absolutely hilarious because he's not registering, and it's just very, very good. And you don't see killers often portrayed like this, very matter-of-factly, very feeling justified in what their actions are and whatnot, and he's just really good and strong in it. The soundtrack is great. The cinematography, of course, great. The editing's great. It's got the De Palma, you know, isms where we, like, have a split the aftershot with a fucking bullfrog, and it focuses on the sound. You can hear all that. The ending is downbeat, like a motherfucker, and I can't believe that it's included in the movie, if that makes sense. Not that scene, but what happens with that scene. It's a good scream. But Dennis Franz is hilarious. He's exactly who you would cast him as. And the other film, he's like a dirty kind of, like, sleazy cop. And this one, he's just a sleazeball, you know, like a scammer kind of guy. But it's just a really solid film that has a lot of fun elements with sound and camera work. And yeah, everybody's great in it. This is a great film. I would definitely rewatch Blowout anytime. Good stuff. Okay, the next up is by far the most serious and haunting film from 1981, and this is Monsters Revenge. That's right, a TV movie, a TV monsters movie. Remember the TV show The Monsters? Not to be confused with The Addams Family, of course, around the same time. So I used to watch The Monsters as a kid. It was always on. You got Herman, Grandpa, Yvonne DiCarlo in here as well, Eddie Monster, and I can't think of the normal girl here, so... yeah, this is 81, so Eddie Munster has been recast, and I think Marilyn's been recast as well. But you still have Yvonne DiCarlo, you still have Al Lewis, and you still have Fred Gwynn, all reprising their roles, and they're all good. This one mostly focuses on Herman Munster and Grandpa Munster, as they are framed as kind of people that terrorize the city. So they go to this wax museum in the very beginning, and they're going around, and they see, you know, the creature from the Black Lagoon, a werewolf, an axe man, all these kind of different waxwork figurines, which is a classic staple in a horror film. And then they see themselves there, so they're very excited about that. Too bad, at night, these wax figures come to life. They're robots, and they kind of carry out the bidding of an evil man. I swear there's a Santo movie with the same plot that I've watched, you know what I mean? Maybe more than once. I feel legit this is a Santo movie. So, and this has the tone of a Santo movie, to be honest. So, of course, the police think that it's Grandpa and... Herman doing all the crimes, even though it's quite obvious. And Marilyn kind of charms the young cop who's on the case, because he's the son of the chief, to kind of help him out here and there. But what they do uncover is, of, of course, you know, the scheme and all this kind of stuff. It's fun. It's silly. It's goofy. The monsters have to dress up incognito. Think Armed and Dangerous, right? In the most ridiculous outfits as waitresses. Come on, guys. I know that's Grandpa Monster and Herman Monster. I'm like 10 miles away. But anyways, Monsters Go Home is fun. It's cute. And there is the only appearance from the shows and the movies of the Phantom of the Opera cousin, who is absolutely ridiculous. All his stuff is super telegraphed and hilarious, but it's worth it. But he's always smiling and singing opera, trying to make an audition. It's absolutely the silliest, dumbest shit I've seen in a very long time. And I don't know. It's just really funny. And just like, the only thing you could do is shake your head and laugh and smile. Because I don't know. I don't know what else to do. But that's Monsters Go Home. If you've seen the Monsters movies, check it out. It's fun. You could do worse. I enjoyed myself. Okay, the last one from 1981 is a Taiwan-Hong Kong co-production. And there's a lot of these Taiwan-Hong Kong co-productions, especially from last year. There was a couple like Devil Cat, and I can't remember all of them. I did about three or four. This one is shocking, with an exclamation point. Now, originally, I don't think this movie had subtitles, but I'm realizing now, messing with subtitle edit and whisper, I can make my own subtitles. They're not great, but I think they will suffice on certain movies just to see them. And this one, somebody had already done the subtitles for it recently, so I was like, oh yes, I will watch this. And kind of in the vein of, you know, some strange Hong Kong movies from 80 and 81, it almost plays like an anthology, right? Last year we had Haunted Tales, and last week I covered another one that was basically three stories in one. And I don't know what the appeal to this is. Maybe there's just incompleted movies. This one is more completed, has a structure and a form and everything like that. So what we have here in the very beginning of the film, this reporter is super interested in this big old haunted house. So he starts to ask around, and every time he gets closer to the house or closer to what happened, he is told the story by, you know, somebody that knows about the house. Some of the stories are the kind of right when it originally happened, a wife killing herself, and now she's haunting the house. I love that scene because the children lead her in, and they're already supposed to be dead. It's just a genuinely creepy, effective scene. Then there is some ridiculous, like there's some silly scenes with eggs being thrown at each other, and egg ghost. There's always misplaced humor in a lot of Hong Kong films. This one's no different. So after that, it's not just like Kung Fu, Sammo Hung or something that matches the demeanor. It's just always like random, like silliness. And that's just par for the course, right? But the stories get more and more brutal or crazy as they go on. A couple murdered in there, and fairly graphic detail for a Taiwan Hong Kong flick from this time on a no budget string, I assume. But as it goes on, we get the last story here, which is the biggest and most elaborate, very much an Amityville Horror style story, right? Get out of this house, get out of this house. Husband isolated from the family, comes back and tries to save. You know, it's not necessarily that the father's completely isolated, but maybe he just doesn't, he lets it go on a little too far than he should. But yeah, there's some gory details in here. There's a really nasty scene where a maid gets blood dripped on her, and I felt genuinely bad for her. And like later they find the maid and it had like done acid, and it burned to her hand and burned her face. But shocking, this Taiwan Hong Kong co-production, you could do much worse. It's a decent solid little kind of Asian film. I would recommend slightly. It's not perfect. It is on YouTube. Hopefully there's subtitles for you. Okay, next up is the Patreon pick, and this is, I believe, from Nick Mua, and he picked 1982's The Entity by Sidney J. Fury, who has a slew of movies. This stars Barbara Hershey, Alex Rocco, Ron Silver, so a really tremendous cast. This is also an immensely popular horror film. I know a lot of my friends like it. I've heard a lot of praise for The Entity. Now, The Entity is a movie that I never had an affinity for or a closeness to. I saw it probably when I was 16 for the first time, and I stepped away and I said some of those special effects are great, and Barbara Hershey is amazing in it. I really only believe one of those now, and it's the latter. Barbara Hershey is tremendous in this. So this is based on a true story, supposedly a true story, kind of in the vein, right? The Exorcist, that was about a boy being possessed. This one follows the story of this single mother, or struggling single mother. She has three kids, and she is constantly raped by a succubus, or incubus, if you will, or poltergeist. I think I'll go poltergeist here. A succubus focuses on men, incubus focuses on women, but I would say some sort of poltergeist, or I would say incubus of sorts. And kind of get a glimpse of her life, right, in the first act, just a small little glimpse, and then the first initial, like, invisible rape is brutal. Like, she just gets slapped and she's confused, and it's really troubling. And it's, again, taking a movie where they actually don't show any like physical person being there raping them, but there is this trauma and this aspect of rape. It's a bizarre film, and it's I guess I would say that Barbara Hershey carries the entire thing. She's phenomenal in it, from her facial expressions to her posture to her demeanor. I just think that she works wonderfully in the role. As far as the story is concerned, I just don't know really where to take it, because I'm very skeptical about these kind of things. But on top of that, I don't believe it's impossible, but the ending is just all over the place, and it doesn't really fit with anything. It doesn't feel like it's from the same movie. And this is the same year as Poltergeist. I don't know if they needed a big push. They needed some sort of big kind of, you know, marquee moment for the trailer or for the film itself, because there's not really like an amazing like climax in the film. But throughout it, she's raped numerous times. And this is the first time watching it on Blu-ray, I noticed how different colors they were. You know, she's laying there, and they'll probably dig a hole in the bed, and you could see her breasts getting felt on, and it's just such obviously a prosthetic this time around, and I don't ever remember it looking that obvious. I don't know if the Blu-ray just looked that good or what, but I'm thinking probably the latter. Ron Silver's also in this. He plays a doctor that's obviously concerned about his patient's health, and I like that stuff. I like his interaction, and she's torn between the scientific element and the religious elements of the thing. And there's an interview with the guy, one of the paranormal investigators who really worked on it, and he's basically, that's what he's looking for, you know, to where science and theology can mix and find a real solution. And I kind of can respect that in a way. But like I said, I think the ending kind of falls apart. I think Barbara Hershey's phenomenal. I like Alex Rocco has a really good scene. He's like portrayed as a strong guy, but he can't even take what's happening to her. But yeah, it's a good film. It's just one that doesn't really work for me. I think it's a tad too long. I think it's a tad too slow. And I just don't really love the end of the film. I think it's a little bit sloppy. As far as special features are concerned, we have new interviews with actor Barbara Hershey and David Labazo, composer Charles Bernstein, editor Frank J. Urotsky, audio commentary by Daniel Kramer, author of Cindy J. Fury, Life and Films, Entity Falls, Flies, and including all in the interview with psychologist Dr. Barry Taff, theatrical trailer, and still gallery. So that is The Entity. I don't love that cover. I like the background. It's pretty cool. But yeah, if it sounds like it's up your alley, check it out. Most people do really enjoy this one, but I think I would take Incubus from 81 over it. I know, right? Okay, questions, comments, concerns. Corey K. 2079. Man, that abomination review reminded me of a movie I've been looking for years. But can't remember the name. That seems very familiar. Only thing I can remember is it takes place at one property mostly. Lots of young folks die. Ghosts, monsters, aliens. I have a badass. Has a badass heavy metal soundtrack that happened to be either the director or lead guy's band. Any help is appreciated. He says definitely low budget, but a lot of charm. Pretty sure it mostly takes place at night. At the house, could be a double wide, definitely a party, and even could be Halloween. I'm thinking Rock and Roll Nightmare, Demon Wind, something along those lines. Let me know if I'm right. Nick Mua from Belgium. Criterion might not be known for releasing horror films, but when they do, it's mouthwateringly delicious. Films like Virgin Spring and The Innocents have enjoyed a second life thanks to Criterion. Apparently, they're due a release of The Others and Freaks come October. Triple Yay says aye. Do you know any pirate horror movies? I guess Deep Rising kind of counts, but not really. Pirates. I mean, there's the Zombies of Mor Tau, which is a black and white zombie film that they're pirates and they come back. There is pirate scenes in movies. Pirates. This is off the top of my head. I know there's got to be some zombie pirates going on there. Skeleton pirates. There's the Night Creatures, which I believe is a Hammer film. I think there's pirates involved with that. I know Hammer has a series of pirate films. Does Night Creatures have pirates in it? I can't fucking remember. The Lost Continent, I think, has pirates in it. And The Island. The Island from 1980 has pirates in it. Watch that one with Michael Caine. That's a good film. Very fun film. Can't remember who directed it off the top of my head. So I recently saw Pieces. Do you prefer the dubbed U.S. version or the Spanish language unrated cut? I've only seen the dubbed American version, but it was unrated version as well. I never watched the cut version of Pieces. I did have an old shitty Diamond DVD back when it was like $1 years and years ago, and I never did watch it. I think I watched it the first time I watched it. Maybe I did watch it on that, but I remember the one I watched mostly was from the nice edition that Grindhouse put on DVD. And he says, "Did you see that? If so, which is okay?" And he asks, "Did you see the director of pieces Juan Piquer Simon's other genre films? If so, which one is your favorite?" "I kind of like Cthulhu Mansion." "It's definitely not Cthulhu Mansion." "Slugs. Slugs is his next best movie. Slugs is great. Cthulhu Mansion is okay." I watched one from 1981 called it was a fantasy with it. Peter Cushing had a small role in Paul Naschy. That wasn't a great film. It was very kiddie friendly. I watched his E.T. Extraterrestrial, which was okay and goofy. I watched, which is horror elements. It's a horror movie, I would say. It's more violent than E.T., of course. And then I would say that Endless Descent, a.k.a. The Rift, is probably his next best movie. That's a pretty solid movie as well after Slugs. But he says, "Good of you to give Killer Joe some love. Many a respectable critic found this freaking film to be equal parts sleazy and trash. See you next week." Yeah. Killer Joe's great. Katum 1472, "You're in for a treat with Blowout and Impulse." Blowout was phenomenal. Jason Ellis 9550, "Great 1981 montage, my friend. Awesome soundtrack as well." Thank you. K Dog, "Thanks for the great reviews." You're welcome. Uzi Suicide 666, "Big recommend on Targets and Masterclass. Heard a lot of good things for years." And then Stephen Hyde 3505, "He gives me a muscle and a fire." Thank you. I appreciate it. We're gonna do this Patreon pick right quick if I can find the paper. Here it is. Five coming out, and then we're gonna hop into the update shortly after this. What do we got here? Mixing it all up. This thing, bag is getting more and more ridiculous. So we have Jason Ward, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. That's that crazy Nick Cage movie. Got a couple more here. James Baker, Survive Style 5. Don't want all them. Then we have John Wilhelm, Lep in the Hood 2. Oh no, man. What are you doing to me? Jim Simon, Roadhouse. There we go. And last one is going to be Nick Mua. For this month, I'm going to go with The Shepherd, a 2021 film starring Katie Dickey. I am not familiar with that movie, but there we go. Let's get into that update. All right, let's get into this update. Sorry, guys. Somebody next door is doing something. I have no idea. It's really loud and annoying. Can't do anything. Show must go on. First up, my Vendor Syndrome order here. What do we have? We have Death in Brunswick, and this is the Sam Neill one. This looked pretty cool, so I picked it up. Gotta love Sam Neill. Don't know much about it. So definitely gonna look forward to that. I've heard the name, just never seen the movie. Next up again, we have Terminal Degradation, the films of John Moritsuga. And, I don't know much about these either, but I know that a lot of people have a lot of love for them. So, My Degradation, Hippie Porn, Terminal USA, Mod Fuck Explosion. I've seen Mod Fuck Explosion. Super bizarre. Fame, Horror, Scum Rock, and Pig Death Machine. Very cool. I can't believe that Mod Fuck Explosion's in here, and I didn't even register that it was in here. It's a very weird movie. I bet these are awesome. This is a 3-disc set. God, I'm learning something new every day. Right? Very cool. I like that. I like that a lot. Double slipcase here. So I can finally retire my old Mod Fuck Explosion DVD. I know my friend Keith will be very ecstatic to see this get a Blu-ray release. I think I picked it up because Art Ettinger mentioned that he thought that was great. So here we have Vengeance is Mine. Another partner label here. Brooke Adams was in here. That's why I picked this up. I always liked her quite a bit. She's really good in Shockwaves, but she's great in Invasion of Body Snatchers, Dead Zone. Just a really good actress. Has a great look about her. I've always kind of had an affinity for her and her performances. Then here we have the Cardona Collection, Volume 2. Yes, these are the films of the Cardona directors, the family. And right on the cover, you got Beaks there. So here's what we have. Beaks, the movie, Under Siege, La Casa Que Arde de Noche, and SOS Conspiracione Bikini. Wow. Oh, wow. This cover's badass. A lot going on there. You got the Beaks up there. This looks like a lot of fun, man. Beaks. The title of that movie always cracked me up because it's like Beaks, the movie, as opposed to the chewing gum. Yeah. These look like a lot of fun. Very cool here. Yeah. I like these. I'll definitely watch Beaks. You know, I don't think I've ever seen Beaks, but I remember it was, I've had the VHS for, 20 years. It's been sitting there. And I guess I just never had the hankering to watch Beaks. Next up, a 4K. Killer Condom. This is a fun movie. It's a bizarre film from, what, 96, a Belgian movie, comedy, about, of course, yes, a killer condom. It's also, like, has a gay characters in here, and I would say it's pro-gay for a horror film. Troma distributed it in the States years ago on DVD. I enjoy the movie. It's been a while since I've seen it, not too long. I think I watched it for the first time a couple years back, actually. It's one of those ones that I just had never, ever seen for some reason, and I, being a big Troma fan and liking bizarre cinema, and it looks like something out of a Hennenlotter, you know, movie, so definitely glad it's on 4K now. Next up is Amazon Jail 1 and 2. I love that cover art right there. That just looks awesome up here in the jungle and everything. Just looks so exploitation insanity. It's just definitely sleazy. I know that Blue Underground put out the old DVDs, so yeah. At least of the first one. I don't think I've ever seen these, but they look incredibly sleazy and fun. Fun, I guess, is a word that you could... very, very different idea of fun, I guess I'll say. Oh, it looks like they sent a booklet for something. I don't know what this fell out of. Oh, maybe this is something they forgot to send last time. I'm not too sure, really. We have two more movies here. First up is Blood Feast, The Adventures of Sergeant Lunch. See, like, I love buying these partner label stuff from Saturn's Core just because you're like, they're releasing stuff that a lot of the stuff is like, I'd never fucking heard of these. And that's rare. I, like, make master list of horror and cult films from a lot of years, and they still manage to pull out stuff that I'm just like, I can't believe that's getting a release. Then we have Guest House Paradiso, which is got the guys, Rick Mile and Adrian, Adrian Edmondson. They were in Bottom and, of course, Young Ones. That's kind of what made them famous. They're a very funny comic duo. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to checking this out. Don't know much about it. I know the cast and everything like that. But, yeah, we're going to hop back to the video. Thank you very much, guys, for watching. And, as always, have a good one.